know why people jump out of perfectly good airplanes. Actually, as any skydiver would say, perfectly good airplane? There's no such thing. I am among the very few who have thrown themselves at the ground and missed, or at least sufficiently delayed the reunion. Most of my 70 or so jumps began the same way, a group of us gearing up for the adventure, putting on heavy-duty harnesses, parachute packs, altimeters, goggles, helmets, etc. Next, we load into the airplane. We sit down, we buckle up, and the plane starts moving. Everyone is really pumped up. We're cheering, high-fiving, and people are saying things like, "Surf's up!" The airplane is abuzz with excitement, bravado, and chatter. As the engines roar, we leave the ground, and the scenery begins to recede in the window. About 10 minutes into our slow ride to altitude, a sort of dark boredom sets in. Veterans are usually napping, leaving rookies oh so very alone with their thoughts. The ground continues to get smaller and smaller as our altimeter needle winds inexorably upwards. At some point, the pilot turns and confides something to a nearby veteran who loudly yells, "2 minutes!" which a handful of voices echo. The plane wakes up, abuzz with activity again, all of us doing our last-minute gear checks, planning exits, and getting ready. And then someone goes to the back of the plane and slides open the plexiglass door to the outside. The plane instantly fills with blustery wind and a hint of airplane exhaust. This is the moment that things get very real for people. This is also our opportunity to see a phenomenon my friends and I have come to call door face. It looks something like this. It is this moment when you realize two things. One, what you imagined this might be like has no relationship to what it's actually like. And two, that you are committed. After all, skydivers will tell you, when you get up to that door, no sounds an awful lot like go. Near the door, a little red light turns green, indicating that we are over our landing area, and people start leaving the airplane. With the airplane literally bouncing like a diving board with each departure, everyone then moves one notch closer to the door and all of its terrible unknownness. Then the person in front of you vanishes, and suddenly it's your turn. You enter the doorway, looking out into the incomprehensible vastness of open sky. The wind buffeting you, and the ground looking less high up and more simply unreal. 1, 2, 3, and you are in free fall. Irrevocably committed. There are a lot of things that you could do at this point. Scream, howl, claw at the air, flap your arms, and maybe turn to cast a longing glance back at the airplane. Sadly, none of them will really change your situation. Scream all you want. The wind will only dry out your mouth. That happened to me. My jump master's right behind me in the video. I'm watching the whole thing, and I'm like, yeah! And he's behind me. As it turns out, the most aerodynamically stable body position in free fall is achieved through relaxing. When you truly relax in free fall, your body naturally assumes the shape of an arch, like this. Until you arch, you're unstable. Control is difficult. After arching, it becomes stable, even graceful. Nothing you are likely to have imagined could have prepared you for this experience. For 60 seemingly eternal seconds, you are simply in the sky, bathed in wind, with no churning stomach and no visual sense of velocity. You can see the horizon in every direction. A friend of mine poetically described it as looking straight into the eye of God. Relaxed and with your eyes open, it's an important distinction. It is a profoundly beautiful, peaceful, humbling, and enlivening experience. It reminds me of when our son Owen was born. I freely admit to more than a little door face. Things happened much faster than Lamaze class had led me to expect. I needed the extreme Lamaze class. That's not what I got. And things got very real in that delivery room. For all of us. And with a baby's cry, we were out of the airplane into a new paradigm. And so was he. The only question was how to respond. This is always the question, isn't it? Life is filled with these transitions. We're always moving from one world into another. How to respond? And more importantly, is our response aligned with our fears, or is our response aligned with our love? I suppose we can always howl, claw at the air, flap our arms, trying somehow to fly back up into that airplane, or we could take the more graceful path, accept, relax, arch, and appreciate the humbling beauty around, between, and within us. In every moment, this choice is ours. Friends, I assert that this community has already exited the airplane. None of us have been here before facing this specific situation. But on the other hand, we've all been here before because we've all experienced transition in our lives. May we always proceed forward, together and aligned with our love. Blessed be, and namaste.
So Moses was standing there at the edge of the Red Sea, and it wasn't moving. Surrounding him, breathing hopeful, formerly enslaved, and recently inspired to leave all they had known behind for a life he promised would be better. Not far behind them, Moses could hear horses charging in the distance and the angry shouts of warriors whose slave labor had just escaped. All Moses and his people had to do was go forward. Freedom was waiting. But there was this sea, this big, deep, wide sea. And so in that moment, you might say that Moses was experiencing door face. Justifiably so. His people looked at him for instruction, and Moses looked at God and did what any great leader would do in such a situation. He started begging. Please, 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 please clear the way, God. Please make a path through the sea. Please. But God had other ideas. Just keep going, God said. You've come this far. You can't turn back now. Just keep going. Have faith. Keep going? Have faith? But there's an ocean. Despite this clear and tangible reality, God would have none of it. Just keep going, God said. Have faith. Moses looked around at his people, and his people looked at him, all of them now with door faces. They could hear Pharaoh's army coming closer. They could feel their hearts beating faster. They were indeed irrevocably committed, but to what? Certain and massive death? But then, from the back of the crowd, a man pushed his way forward. Nachshon was his name. A regular guy, certainly he'd never heard a voice from a burning bush. But in that moment, this regular man stepped forward and he started walking into the sea. Moses just stared at him, and others started to point and yell out, "What are you doing? Are you crazy?" But Nachshon just kept going. He waded through the rising tide, and the water hit his calves. The crowd became silent, just watching him. He kept walking. Water hit his waist. He kept walking. The water came up to his chest and then his shoulders. He kept walking. The water was all around him until finally it was at his nostrils, about to fill his lungs. And it was at that moment the Red Sea parted. And the Israelites could continue their journey to freedom, moving safely through the walls of water, safely through the sea. What gives someone the courage to do something so bold and yet so necessary? What allows us to risk ourselves for the sake of liberation, our own or others? What gives us the strength not just to talk about transformation, but to act, to walk into the fire of personal and communal change, to step into the sea? What makes us that brave? Our common misunderstanding is that such courage comes from fearlessness. We imagine fear itself must be defeated. Anxiety and worry must be squashed as a source of shame. Be not afraid, the Hebrew prophets and Jesus and American presidents all urge. We go to war on terror. But fear and terror are a normal human response to this world we live in. The diagnosable disorder should not be anxiety, but a lack of anxiety. Right? I mean, that would be something to wonder about. If you weren't afraid, be afraid. I am, a lot of the time. There's so much we risk in this life by showing up with our whole hearts. So much that's broken that we don't have time to understand, let alone help fix. So much we don't have control over. So much that can and does go terribly wrong. I mean, it's terrifying. Life is so terrifying. But so what? I mean, courage doesn't care whether life is terrifying and whether you're afraid. In fact, psychologists and neuroscientists, philosophers and theologians all repeatedly affirm that how big our brave is not at all related to how big our fear is. Bravery comes from somewhere else. But where? Black lesbian feminist Audre Lorde, a woman whose brave was enormous, observed, "When I dare to use my strength in the service of my vision, it becomes less and less important whether I am afraid." All my research has led me back to this. Courage comes, again, not from fearlessness, but from a sense of duty. We act courageously when we believe we are serving our vision. When I dare to use my strength in the service of my vision, it becomes less and less important whether I am afraid. Keep walking. Have faith. Don't turn back. Now, duty is not a word I hear Unitarian Universalists use too often. In fact, it's not really associated with religious or other kinds of liberals at all. Maybe because it implies to us a lack of choice, something we have to do, not because we've decided on our own accord that it was good or right. But like other words we may squirm about, we disregard and misunderstand it to our own detriment. As a covenantal faith, defined not by our shared beliefs, but by our shared commitments, duty seems to me like a very Unitarian Universalist word. We come together out of a shared sense of duty that is ours because, not because we have no choice, but because we have chosen these sacred obligations. This is our great covenant. We have thought carefully and chosen to dwell together, to seek the truth, to serve in love. And as Nachshon reminds us, fulfilling your duty in this way need not diminish freedom, and in fact, it may be exactly what enables it. Where it gets complicated, however, is understanding exactly what our duty is and how following it would translate into real life. As psychologist Cynthia Puri puts it, quote, "I don't think any efforts towards courage is going to go that far unless you help people decide what's important." Now, when I got the news of Pete Seeger's death this week, I was puzzling out this precise question. How should we decide what's important? What tools should we turn to determine our sense of duty? I figured someone who lived as bravely as Pete did might have some ideas about this. My reading didn't take long. The second interview I came across, Pete was sharing his thoughts about how to motivate people to do the right thing, how to get them to act on their ideals. It was an interview from 3 years ago, which means he was 91. Now just think, after all he had seen and experienced, the House committee getting blacklisted, his optimism remained inspiring. He still believed, as Roger said, he still believed that the right song, sung together, could inspire people to change the world. Now, the right song required two things, according to Pete. First, it needed to embolden a sense of duty. Now, seriously, that's the word he used. He said, the first thing that a right song needs to do is inspire in us a sense of duty. But simultaneously, the song must foster an experience of reverence, which he went on to describe as an experience that allows us to perceive, quote, that the present holds within itself the complete sum of existence, forwards and backwards, that great amplitude of time, which is eternity. It is that moment where you leap from the plane and you are held by the sky. When you realize simply by existing, you are safe. You belong here in the web of life. In all your beauty and imperfection, you belong here. You are loved and held and seen and known, and you belong. This feeling, that's reverence. Some of us may be grateful to know you don't need to jump out of an airplane to experience it. I felt it the first time I saw an older man carrying a sign that said, "I love my gay daughter," in a pride parade. I felt it at hospital bedsides, out on a run, looking in my kids' faces, and in the deep belly laughter shared amongst friends. Many Sundays, I've felt it here with all of you. Wherever we find them, as Seeger saw it, these experiences of reverence tell us what matters. They tell us what is worth stepping into the ocean for. Now, as soon as I read this, I knew he was right. Bravery motivated by duty without reverence isn't bravery. It's ego and arrogance and often hubris. But bravery motivated by duty and reverence grounds our action in relationship in the fullest sense. Where duty is aligned with the first principle, our individual worth, our capacity, reverence would draw from the seventh, acknowledging the great interdependent web of existence of which we are simply a part. Duty inspires confidence, reverence, humility. Moral courage requires both. But that's not all. There's one final thing psychologists say helps inspire a sense of courage, and for that, I need to tell you a story. It was just over 2 years ago. I was newly ordained, serving a church that was fine, but wasn't my call, when I got a phone call from the Mountain Desert District executive, the Reverend Nancy Bowen. She said, "The church in Fort Collins is probably going to be hiring a second minister, and you should apply." A few years before that, Nancy and I had talked about my specific sense of call. I told her, "I feel like I'm supposed to serve on the front range. These are my people. And my experience and my joy tells me I'm supposed to be in a big church." Now, how such a thing would happen, we had at the time no idea. No possibilities existed. But with all my heart, I felt it was right. So she said she'd keep an eye out. Which means a few years later, when she called to tell me about the potential position, I was cautiously enthusiastic. Might it be? No way to know then. Just had to let it play out. Now, I remember vividly the interview, a group of then strangers, now familiar friends, all gathered in the Sokolovsky's home. The search committee's thoughtful questions clearly communicated their commitment to making the right choice for the congregation they so obviously loved. Duty, based in reverence. We reflected on our mutual desire for a long-term partnership, and I confessed my overdeveloped sense of loyalty. And I said, based on Mark's tenure, that seems that's something we might share. They laughed. We were arching and relaxed, taking it all in. But then at the end of the interview, Mark said, "I think you should know I'm going to retire in 2 years. What do you think about that?" he asked. And you know what I said? I said, "I'm not afraid." I said, "I have a very strong theology of risk." Which was halfway true. I mean, the theology part, that was definitely true. But the other part, I mean, being with a church who's letting go of its beloved minister of 23 years, being present as the church transitions fully and from a setup for about 250 members to the system, structures, and finances to support its nearly 600 members, 200 friends, and 300 children and youth, not to mention continuing to reach out their impact into the wider community with its vision of justice and love, helping a congregation warmly welcome and receive the leadership of a yet-to-be-determined interim senior minister. Being present and open to all of these changes, this time of great transformation, trying to find my place, remaining unattached to outcomes. And then on top of all of this, the usual heartbreaks and unknowns of ministry, of parenthood, and of life. I mean, I think I'm going to have to revise my answer. I am afraid. Door face. Who wouldn't be? But from that very first interview, and every single day since, my sense of reverence, that is, my deep sense of being connected to something greater. And the way I experience that with you, in this place, in our work, my sense of duty that comes from that, my sense of call, these things tell me I can do no other, so I'm in the water, it's up to here. And it turns out it's great fun, great joy. Now, in terms of the future, some wonder if I will apply to be the senior minister. My only faithful answer for you all is, I don't know. Who will we be a year from now? Who will this congregation be without Mark's and Vicky's presence? Who will I be as a minister? How will I understand my call then? How will we together change as we take this great leap? It's not time to know. The transformative power of courageous love is doing its work on us. Time is doing its work. We just have to let it. Just relax. Arch. Be present. The sky is ready to hold us, and it is so beautiful. Life invites us into such holy work. Life is always asking us to show it how big our brave is. And lucky for us, these next few years will invite a little extra opportunity to respond. But in reality, this is always our charge. As Unitarian theologian James Luther Adams said, church is the place where you get to practice what it means to be human, which is the third and final requirement for bravery: practice. Psychologists tell us that preparation breeds confidence in our capacity, builds muscle memory for saying or doing the right thing when the opportunity arrives. Before you jump out of that plane, you do train, right? A lot, I'd imagine. And that's us. That's this. We are your spring training, your two-a-days, your CrossFit, pick your sport or some other metaphor that works for you. We are the place that prepares you to take that step for yourself, for us all, to bring us all just a little closer to the promised land. My friends, grounded in the holy, fulfilling our sense of our deepest duty, practicing together, may we grow big, brave hearts here so that we may answer life's call and step into the water together. May it be so. And amen.